When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, welcome to Mick Clifford Podcast, The Irish Examiner. Now, Michael Lynn is a name that'll be familiar to some, but I suspect not all of you. Mr. Lynn was a solicitor who became a property developer during the Celtic Tiger years. He engaged in wholesale fraud and then he skipped the country before he could be brought to account in both the civil and criminal courts. After years on the run, he was eventually arrested and held in Brazil. He spent over 4 years in appalling conditions in prisons in that country, and they do have some appalling conditions, before finally being extradited back here, where he eventually stood trial and was convicted of fraud-related crimes. He's now serving a prison sentence. For many people, Lynn sums up the excesses and criminality of those years when, I think, the whole country was living on borrowed money. But as with all these things, some people went far further than others and reaped far more than others, and some among them went overboard and went into criminality, like Michael Lynn. And I think a lot of people associate him with those times. Now, one person who followed the case closely and who particularly went on the hunt for Mr. Lynn when the time came was Irish Mail on Sunday investigations editor Michael Farrell. Mick has now written a book that I have to say reads like a thriller. Fugitive, the Michael Lynn story, is out now. It's published by Merriam Press. And I'm joined now by Michael Farrell. Michael, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Mick. Thanks for having me on.
Michael, I suppose just for some people, and others who perhaps are a bit hazy on him, who would have been clued in at the time, just give us a quick run through his origins, his rise to the point where the walls came tumbling down, I suppose you could say, and his doing a runner.
Sure. Well, Michael Lynn grew up in Cross Malina in County Mayo. He was the son of a hardworking farmer there. He was a normal boy in many ways, and his parents saved hard to send him to college, and he went to study law in Trinity College. After that, he became a lawyer in Dublin. He founded his own practice in Blanchardstown around about the early 2000s. And in doing so, he learned a lot about the property game. He learned how to do conveyancing, how to buy and sell properties, and he developed relationships with bankers who taught him a thing or two as well. The reason he's famous, of course, is that one of the tricks he learned, or one of the loopholes he learned, which was in place back then, it's been tightened up a little bit now, but he learned that a lawyer in the middle of a property transaction had a lot of power. The banks relied on that lawyer to give the banks a guarantee that money lent against a property had actually been used for that property, and that the property's deeds had been registered in favor of the bank. So Lynn realized that he could borrow money from number one bank to buy a property, fail to register it as he was supposed to, but tell the bank he had done so. And then, of course, he could go to another bank and borrow money against the same property, and again and again and again. So one of the good examples of that is a house called Glen Lyon House in Howth, which was a trophy home at the time worth 5 million euro. Lynn would have borrowed 4 or 5 million euro from the first bank to supposedly buy that house, and then did the same again with the second and third and fourth bank, but only one of those banks could ultimately have recourse to the actual home, and the rest at the end of the day would lose out. So in behaving like that for a period of about a year between 2006 and 2007, he was able to borrow many tens of millions of euro for which the banks had very little recourse.
That's the first interesting element, Michael, that it was going on, relatively speaking, for such a short time, and that so much damage could be done within that time. And I just want to quote briefly one passage in the book, just to give people an indication of the scale of what was going on. And I'm just quoting you here. He said, "When the dust settled, the astonishing scale of Lynn's deception throughout 2007 became apparent. In January, he had drawn down 1.4 million loan from Irish Nationwide, which he would top up in April by a further 4.125 million. In February, he borrowed 600,000 from Ulster Bank. In March, National Irish Bank gave him 1.33 million and Anglo-Irish Bank loaned him 1.14 million. In April, Bank of Scotland advanced 3.85 million and in June, Permanent TSB lent him 3.725 million. In August, ACC Bank gave him 3.78 million. I mean, it's quite astonishing. This guy, as you say, Michael, he was a solicitor and all of these loans were given on the basis, what you could effectively say was trust, that on the basis that you're a solicitor, therefore we trust that you are doing, as you say, in relation to this money being put towards a mortgage in a particular house.
Yeah, he realised that as the trusted man in the middle, he could manipulate that system. And that in the reckless kind of lending that was going on, the Celtic Tiger, nobody was really watching. And it was interesting that he was actually able to do that by and large while not even in the country himself. At the time that he stole the money he's convicted of stealing, he was actually abroad most of the time. And he relied on other staff in his office who have testified in both of his trials to advance the loan applications with the various banks. And when you look at those applications, it is astonishing because you see an initial form go in with maybe 10 Dublin rental houses on it that he might be buying in one tranche. And that might go into Ulster Bank. And then the next week or, you know, a few days after, the very same list of properties would go into another bank. And the banks, in many cases, would lend really quickly. He was able to obtain finance in a matter of days. He could borrow 10 million euro in 2 or 3 days on the say-so of his undertaking, his promise, and on also because of the urgency of the banks to lend at the time. That was the climate that allowed this kind of fraud to happen, you know?
Yeah, and that is the other point. No, notwithstanding, and it is not a mitigation in any way whatsoever for the crime he was involved in. But it is really an indication of how insane the banks were behaving, that they were doing this with one solicitor. And OK, he was taking advantage of it. But there were hundreds, if not thousands of people taking out loans, not for any criminal purposes, but on the basis it was so easy to get this money and the banks were just throwing it out because they were making money on it. It was crazy. One quick thing, Michael, and this is a personal recollection, and I only copped it when Lynn's crimes came to public attention, I think it's about a year or so later. I think it was 2006 All Ireland, no, it was Kerry and Mayo. And I know they played a few times in the audience. I was at most of those games, it was 06 or 07. I think it might have been the 06 All Ireland. A centre page spread in the match programme was for a company I now know was Kendar Holdings. But what really grabbed me was that the two figures who were advertising it, both of whom hadn't denied OTA what Lynn was up to, but they were. Rui Costa, Portuguese really soccer star, glamorous, tanned, etc., the whole thing. And hearty son of the old soil, Willie Joe Padden from County Mayo. And I just thought juxtaposition between the two of them spoke about how far the country appeared to have come at that time. Of course, we now know it was all an illusion. But that was Kendar Holdings, Lynn's outfit, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting you raised that programme. That was... Lynn was able to use sports contacts throughout the country, particular GAA stars, not just in Mayo, but in all counties, rugby stars and soccer stars. Ray Houghton was another person he had at one of his launches at one time. He was able to use Ireland's fascination with famous sports stars to sell properties. And I'm glad you raised it because one of the problems in telling the story of Michael Lynn is that most people think it's just a story about the banks. And maybe people don't care too much about the banks losing a few quid given what we've given them over the last decade and a half. But Lynn's story is not just a man robbing from banks who don't suffer. There are many, many victims involved in Lynn's story who gave him money, their life savings in many cases, to buy apartments abroad that were never built. And he was able to do that. He was able to reach those people by, unbeknownst to them, using those very sports stars you're mentioning to sell throughout the country. And, you know, some of those victims, I mean, I mentioned one of them in the book. They're very, very sad stories. Right. If you want me to go into them, I mean, they're
just end that one briefly there, if you could.
Yeah, Sean O'Mahony is a Kerry publican. And at the time, his wife worked for the Department of Justice. She actually did the Garda payroll, but she got cancer and she left with a payout to see out her days. She got about 45, 50 grand at the time. And she wanted a legacy for her two daughters. They had two young daughters. And she decided, because of the publicity attached to buying property at the time back then in the Celtic Tiger, she decided that legacy would be an apartment for the kids and her husband to go to in her memory, I suppose, in Bansko, a ski resort in Bulgaria, where one of Lynn's developments was being built. She spent the $45,000 on that apartment, put the money down up front through an agent in Limerick. And then, of course, she got very sick and she was in hospital one day when the whole Lynn story blew up for the first time in October 2007. He was coming out of court on the front of the RTE News at 6 o'clock, and she turned to Sean, her husband, and said, "Look, put on the news, we'll have a look at the news." And when he turned the news on, it was Michael Lynn coming out of court with his wife, Breed Murphy, by his side. And before the news was over, she got a heart attack and died. You know, and Sean and many others like him went to the guards and made criminal complaints. The Gardaí investigated those complaints and files went to the DPP. But because the crimes, the money had been sent abroad, the DPP and the Irish authorities couldn't really trace it properly. And those guys fell through the cracks. So while we did get a prosecution for money stolen from banks, the real victims, if you like, the everyday men and women up and down the country, hundreds of them who spent money for apartments they never got, those stories haven't been told, and they never got justice at all.
Very true. And it's funny you mentioned that about they couldn't pursue that case because there was an element of it abroad. The other thing that struck me in terms of the book, Michael, was how long it actually took the guards to compile a case that they were able to leave the DPP, and how he was able to operate in that lacuna for, what, 3 or 4 years anyway, with no charges, so therefore no possible extradition. And in one case, was it from Bulgaria, he was actually arrested and held and let go again because the guards had no didn't have the file prepared at the time.
Yeah, listen, I mean, we don't have a proud history in this country of being able to investigate white-collar crime properly. And other kinds of crime, drug crime and stuff like that, gets a lot of attention, gets a lot of press. It's almost entertainment in some ways. But white-collar crime does as much damage, if not more, I would argue, than your average sort of drug crime, you know. There are real victims up and down the country all the time who are losing 500 euro, 5 grand here and there. And the guards, by and large, have been underfunded by the authorities to actually investigate white-collar crime properly. And Lynn's case is a good example. At the time that he went on the run in 2007, the fraud squad was little more than an office with a few people in it. Massively under-resourced for what it was about to be hit with when the Celtic Tiger came along and the Anglo cases and all those big banking cases came. It's better now, it's different now, but it's still not good enough, I would argue. And one of the things I do every morning is that overnight I'm on an FBI kind of press list, and they send you through the white-collar cases that they've prosecuted or they've indicted every day. And every now and again, maybe once a week, I'll click into the list and just click into one of the cases to see how fraud can be investigated properly when it is done properly. And really, we don't do it properly at all. Now, there are very, very, very committed and very good members of the force who are brilliant in what they do, but they're not resourced to the level they should be, I would argue. And I think that's something that society should look at somewhere down the road.
Absolutely, no question. And right through those years, and I always remember the one, it was, I think, the predecessor to the Director of Corporate Enforcement, or maybe was Director of Corporate Enforcement, at the height of those Celtic Tiger years, they were desperate for resources. And I specifically remember Bertie Hearn was Taoiseach, and he was asked about it in the Dáil, making an announcement they'll have to get in line with everyone else. And areas like that, like I've done a lot of work in the area of building regulations and fire safety, what was done there, and all of that thing. Regulation, policing, it was all live mat it, lads, stand back, and if anything goes terribly wrong, we'll try and investigate it. But otherwise, huge amount wasn't necessarily a turn of blind eye, but it was. Didn't really want to know what was going on. Very true, Michael.
To know what's really happening, subscribe to the Irish Examiner today at irishexaminer.com/subscribe.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
No. As we say around autumn of 2007, he gets rumbled. There's proceedings begin in the High Court. He's due in the High Court. Next thing, he disappears. Mm. You were on the case then, Michael, and you went tracking him to, I think, both Portugal and Bulgaria.
Yeah, well, I was sitting in the chair I'm sitting in now at my office at home when my phone rang, and it was my newspaper, the Irish Mail, on Sunday, tasking me with going and finding this guy. And I'll be frank with you, I'll be honest, it was the last thing I wanted to do. I didn't think it would be possible for anyone to go and find him. It was the beginning of 2008. He'd been on the run for more than a month ahead of me. So yeah, that was my job. I just had to drop everything and begin to research who he was from the bottom up and try and draw connections and develop money leads and follow money trails through his various companies wherever they went. The ultimate aim, of course, was to get in front of him and interview him, which we did achieve, and we can talk about that in a while if you like. But looking back on it, one of the most interesting aspects of being given that job was not getting the interview, but it was the stuff we learnt on the way to getting the interview. It took more than a year before we managed to get an interview with him, but in pursuing the money leads and the money trails throughout Europe where he had businesses and development sites, we learnt a lot. You know, we learned how, after he went on the run, he very quickly started to disseminate or sell off any assets he could lay his hands on. He would change the names of his development firms in Portugal and Bulgaria and elsewhere into new companies, and those new companies would have strange ownership structures where the owners remained secret in strange locations like Panama and the Seychelles, offshore locations that couldn't be traced back to him. And the interesting thing about that is that 17 years later, even during his retrial, which finished in December 2023, the Gardaí had begun a new money laundering investigation into that very scenario, the funds that he had siphoned away back then, and whether those monies have now been brought back into Ireland to help set him up again in business. And we've seen during the trial, the guards were actively investigating that because, and the new trail started because between his first trial in 2022 and his retrial in 2023, Lynn moved house. He was living in a rental house in near Arklow and Wicklow, but he moved to a new house. And that new house had been purchased for about 450,000, and it had been done up extensively to a very nice spec. And the owner of that house was a company being run by a Bulgarian associate whose name I was very familiar with, because that guy is the same person who I watched 17 years ago taking control of Lynn's assets in Portugal and elsewhere as those new structures were set up.
I was staggered when I saw that, Michael, not to intervene, but just you're jumping ahead, I think, just so people okay. will keep a train with things. I was staggered when I saw that stuff, that after all of this, that was still going on. But we will come to that. One quick, sorry, just, and don't mean to be jumping around the place, but I just saw this as well, and I thought, back again to the culture of lending there, and you're referring here to Judge Johnson in the High Court, and the element about commission for the lenders and the individuals, and a bonanza of up to 1% or €10,000 for every million. So say, for instance, Lynn gets 10 million, you're talking about 100 grand for the person in the bank who was responsible for lending him the money as a commission, as a bonus. Jesus, the thing was insane. But getting back to you and your involvement. So number of times you went out to Portugal, you went out to Bulgaria, you were tracking him. Tell us exactly how, where and when you eventually met him and he agreed to sit down with you.
Sure. Well, the problem in that process of trying to get in front of him was that we would get a tip off that he might be in Budapest one day, and we'd tear off, but we'd arrive 24 hours late and he'd have moved on. And that happened repeatedly. We'd get a tip off, he'd be in Portugal, but we'd miss him by a day. He'd be in Sofia, but we'd miss him by a day. So that finally changed after more than a year when, I suppose at that stage, we developed a lot of contacts and sources around the place who were beginning to give us better information. And greed, at the end of the day, is what helped me get in front of Lynn. Lynn's own greed, because even though he'd sold off his main Portuguese development, which is a place called Cabanas, he was still in control of it realistically. And the people who did own apartments there were locked out of the swimming pool there. And Lynn had begun to demand an extra payment of 40 grand if they were to be allowed back into the swimming pool area. So that meant the residents actually had to set up a meeting with him at which he had to attend to do this deal or to talk to them and get the money he wanted. So one of those residents tipped me off that this meeting was going to happen. We were lucky to get there. It was a time of a terrible storm, but I won't go into all that complications. But we travelled overnight and got there just on time, parked outside a hotel where the meeting was going to happen and waited. Actually, my photographer parked in the car and I went down the road to pay for the ticket because we didn't want to be disrupted by a ticket warden who'd ruin everything just as Lynn came out and we tried to take his picture or something. And as I ran down the street to buy a ticket, Lynn was coming against me the other way. So I stepped off the footpath and let him off into the meeting and we waited for him to come out.
Did you recognise him straight away?
Recognised him straight away, yeah. I mean, he was bigger in person than I thought he would be. But I recognised him straight away, yeah. I mean, I have an ability in my job to put someone's face in my head and never forget it and pick them out of a crowd anywhere. So, yeah, I recognised him. When he came out, I ran after him. We got the pictures. I caught up with him just as he was getting back into his car. And he didn't initially want to talk. He knew who I was. He'd read the stuff I'd been writing. But something clicked in him. You know, I said, look, let's just go for a coffee. Let's never mind an interview, which he said he wouldn't give me. Let's just sit down and have a chat. And something clicked in him. And he is impulsive that way. It's one of the character traits that he has. And on impulse, he just said, yeah, okay, let's sit down for a coffee. And then he spoke for an hour and he kind of spilled his soul, if you like, about what it was like being on the run, how he hadn't intended this stuff to happen, you know, all sorts of woe is me stuff. At the end of it, I just said, look, anything you've told me there, what would be wrong telling that story on, you know, in a real interview? And he thought about it for a second and said, yeah, okay, go for it. We booked a hotel room for an hour later. I wasn't sure whether he'd show up, but he actually did show up and he sat down and he did the full interview. And, you know, he was a tortured man in many ways. I mean, he did acknowledge that he had done wrong. He acknowledged that he'd been unethical or corrupt. He acknowledged that he owed people money. He spoke about the figures he owed, which was interesting because, of course, Lynn was only prosecuted for, only convicted for stealing 18 million. He was put on trial for stealing 21 million or 27 million. But when he went on the run initially, there was 80 million missing from the Irish banks. And there was also, in his own estimation, there was 13 million that he had obtained from the various victims we spoke about earlier who put deposits on apartments that were never built.
And how, Michael, did you find him on a human level?
You know, Lynn is a very nice, on the face of it, very nice, interesting, happy-go-lucky, charming fella, you know. He'd be a great man to have a pint with. He'd be the life and soul of any party.
He's a
musician, yeah. He was famed for sitting up in any bar where there was a piano. He'd take over the piano and, you know, the session would be all led by him. But he's a very clever man, I think, and his mind spins very quickly. He's like a politician in many ways. He can come down, and I say come down because I think he's actually cleverer than most people. He can come down to whatever level he finds someone else at, and he can do that instantly and associate with them. And that allows him to be the perfect salesman. That allows him to be the perfect con man. I mean, if you talk to guards, the guards will tell you that con men are always very believable, you know. And I picked up a cheap thriller last night as I finished work and sat down to read it. And there was a line in it that reminded me of Lynn. It was about how the first person a con man has to con is himself. And, you know, Lynn believed his own spiel 100%. So he was utterly believable in person if you were trusting him with your money.
You know? I'm always fascinated by that that in different scenarios, particularly people involved in dishonesty, in some cases, people involved in quite possibly killing people, but their capacity to tell themselves a different story effectively, and that becomes their story.
I suppose they have to in some ways, you know. Yeah. And I think Lynn ultimately reached, we'll get onto it later maybe, but I think he reached a place after a number of years on the run where he actually probably had to have some sort of separation in his mind from what he'd done to just live the rest of his life without being burdened by guilt, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure he ever got out from underneath the guilt he felt. And I do think he felt some.
Okay. And then eventually, as we said, the Gardaí managed to get a case together. DPP went after him, applied for extradition. He moves to Brazil. In the footsteps, you could say, of Ronnie Briggs, the great train robber who spent a very long time over there until he was eventually extradited, I think not too long before he died. But anyway, Lynn moves over there and his ace there, Michael, is at the time there was a law, probably still pertains, but if you're the parent of somebody born in the country, you can't be extradited. And the first child he had with his wife, Breed, was born in Brazil, and it looked for a while like he was on the pig's back, sorted, I ain't never going home.
Yeah. Brazil is interesting. There are two narratives about Brazil, and you can choose which one you believe. There's Lynn's narrative, which is that he and his wife were trying for kids and they weren't succeeding. And a specialist in Sao Paulo was recommended. So they went there and lo and behold, it worked and they started having kids there. That's his narrative and that's what he's told the court. There's a different narrative, which I think is interesting. He was preparing to go to Brazil before he even fled the country and before he committed the crimes he was convicted of. So in January 2007, now he didn't go on the run until December 2007. In January 2007, he made his first trip to Brazil with one of his managers at the time. And he had meetings with lawyers over there. And he specifically wanted advice on how to set up companies there, how to transfer money from Europe into Brazil safely, but also how to become a resident in Brazil. So I think and I suspect he was planning Brazil as an outlet if he ever needed it, even before he ever went on the run anywhere. Of course, when he did go to Brazil around about 2011, yes, he had the child thanks to the help that he and Breed got, but it also sort of coincided almost. I mean, the charges weren't laid against him until after he was already in Brazil, but the guards were getting very close to raising charges against him. They had organized to meet him four times in different places in Europe, meetings that he at the last minute cancelled every time. And he had also sought guarantees from the guards that if they went abroad to meet him in Portugal or wherever it would be, that they wouldn't issue a warrant for his arrest until 4 weeks after the meeting. So he was conscious of the danger that was there for him if he remained in Europe. And charges were ultimately filed after he went to Brazil.
That is an element I found fascinating in your account. That business of January 07. And, you know, when you think back, January 07, well, I don't know, but I'm guessing to a large extent, most people, even those who perhaps were plugged into the madness of the lending and building boom that was going on, would, at that point, I doubt if they would have predicted anything near what was about to fall in terms of the economy and everything. Yet this guy, it would appear, was ahead of the game. He was taking out his insurance policy, even when, you know, quite possibly it looked like there was going to be no come down from this. He'd be able to sort out A for B and et cetera, et cetera. And you know, he the fact that he was checking out Brazil at that stage says a lot. But go on anyway. Sorry, anyway, as I say, their first child is born there.
First child was born in 2011. And there was a second child on the way. Breed was heavily pregnant when Lynn was finally arrested in 2013. And actually on that, it's interesting that he could have got away with this. He could have very easily got away with this by going to Brazil. That plan could have worked were it not for Alan Shatter being justice minister at the time. Because Alan Shatter specifically took a personal interest in the Lynn case, Shatter being a solicitor himself, a prominent member of the legal community. Shatter abhorred what Lynn had done to the reputation of the legal community. And it was Shatter who went to cabinet and said, look, lads, we have to see if we can do something to get Lynn back. That resulted in private secret negotiations that even the guards weren't aware of between the Department of Foreign Affairs and the Brazilian authorities to do a reciprocal extradition deal, a once-off. You're right, we still don't have a formal extradition deal with Brazil, but the deal was that we give them one of our prisoners of their nationality if they gave us one of ours. And the one we wanted was Lynn, of course. And that's how it happened. So in 2013, he was arrested. Breed was heavily pregnant at the time. He was sent to a facility called Cotel, which is a hellhole of a remand prison about an hour outside Recife, the city he was living in. And he could have turned around at any point and accepted the extradition and said, right, lads, I'll go home voluntarily. But he didn't. He fought it at every single step of the way. And one of the things he achieved or was trying to achieve in fighting it was to avoid it, was to stay in Brazil. So one of the ways of doing that was to have more Brazilian children. And of course, thanks to conjugal visits, he had two further children while in prison. And at the end of it, he had four Brazilian-born kids, a fact which he argued to the courts in Brazil should strengthen his argument not to be sent back to Ireland. But it didn't work.
Was some of the argument literally down to the number of children he had born in Brazil?
He did raise that point in the Supreme Court in Brazil, yeah. You know, you're talking about the lives of four Brazilian-born children here, Your Honour, and they deserve to be left in their home country, you know.
The other thing, again, that jumps out there is, and you, again, you describe very well, Michael, the conditions in what you could call a hellhole. Christ, they were, you know, they were absolutely, for anybody who'd be used to Western European prisons, they were absolutely appalling. And yet, he was willing to put up with that, to endure that, for what he must have known was even a very slim hope that he wouldn't be extradited.
Yeah, it's just extraordinary. His narrative to explain that involves the difficulty that he and Breed had having children, and now that they were able to do it, it was great to be able to keep doing it. But it doesn't stack up in my estimation. You know, he was delaying things as much as he could to see could he get away with this, could he not be sent home. And he achieved other things by waiting as well. I mean, he achieved a reduction in the charges he was facing here in Ireland. He was ultimately put on trial for 21 charges of simple theft. And that's a charge that applies to someone who steals a bottle of wine and an off license. But in his case, it was millions in a bank. But he was originally charged with further charges of fraud and use of a false instrument and complex mechanisms like that. Those charges he successfully had dropped because they didn't correspond with Brazilian law. And you can't extradite someone from Brazil to face a crime that doesn't exist in Brazil. So he succeeded in that way as well, by minimising the charges he faced here.
He did 4 years in a Brazilian prison, or over 4 years for that. Eventually, as you say, of course, he got extradited. He was brought back. He was given bail. I mean, lucky enough to get that in some ways, I suppose. But I suppose it was unlikely he was going to do a runner again. But anyway, he went to the first trial. What was the outcome of the first trial then?
First trial in 2022 resulted in a hung jury.
Yeah.
That actually surprised everybody. I don't think Lynn expected that. I don't think the DPP or the guards expected that. But it was, I think personally, and this is just my view, it was a factor of how long the trial went on. The trial began in February 2020 and went on until June. And for the vast majority of that time, it was a very complex document-based trial involving more than a million documents. And I think it bored the jury senseless quite quickly. And I think a lot of them actually probably lost interest. And Lynn, interestingly, didn't come out with the defence that worked for him at the end until the very end of that trial. He sat for months and let his lawyers argue, on legal aid, of course, all sorts of reasons why he shouldn't be put away, including absolutely absurd arguments that, you know, he hadn't actually stolen money. What had gone missing from the bank was an equitable interest in a transfer. You know, stupid, legal, complex arguments that are Alice in Wonderland stuff the judge described
it as.
It was
lying in my bank account, my lord.
But when he got on the stand, that's what turned the whole thing. I mean, he's a very charismatic man. He's a performer, musician, as you said. He's a salesman. He was very emotional. And he told a story when he got on the stand for about a week that absolutely transfixed the jury. And it was a story that no one had heard before, except myself, of course, because he told me 10 years earlier about how he alleged he was in cahoots with bankers, that bankers had accepted bribes to help him get loans, and that they knew what he was doing. And it was all a secret system for the privilege to access money. Now, he never produced any proof of that. He named all these bankers, of course, but he never produced any proof of it. But the strength of his performance, I think, turned enough of the jury that they couldn't decide unanimously one way or the other. So the jury
and how
was hung.
How did he do under cross-examination after giving evidence?
I think he did just as well. You know, he was pretty unflappable at that stage. He'd been on the stand for nearly a week. I'm not sure the prosecution were prepared for facing the strength of character that man has. And they were surprised as anyone when they heard this defence. They didn't expect it. You know, he talked to me years earlier about bribing these bankers allegedly, but they didn't have an inkling of what was coming down the line. And when he suddenly named all of these people in court, of course, the DPP and the prosecution and the guards had to go off and find these people and bring them into court and take fresh statements. And they all denied it, of course, but it set the prosecution back and it got Lynn off, if you like, the first time. But the second time around, the trial was much faster. It was much snappier. The prosecution knew what was coming. Anyone who'd watched the news in the previous year, which presumably most of the jury had, knew what his defence had been the first time. And strangely, Lynn was a bit tired, I felt, when he got on the stand in the second trial. He didn't give it the oomph he had the first time around. He was almost resigned, I think, to getting it over with. He just wanted to move on. and he was found guilty.
And the sentence then, Michael, taking into account time served and all, how much he was taken into custody after having been on bail, what was the effective sentence from there on?
Yeah, he was given a headline sentence of 16 years and something, but that was reduced to take account of the terrible conditions he'd faced in prison in Brazil. One of his cellmates was a German crook who had been extradited before Lynn, and he had successfully argued in the German courts that every day in prison in Brazil was worth 2.5 days in a German prison. So Lynn submitted that German ruling to the courts here when it came to sentencing, and he was given 7.5 years, I think, off for the 4.5 years he'd spent in prison in Brazil and the bit of time he'd spent on remand here before he got bail as well. So ultimately he will do, with good behaviour, whatever, he'll be out in less than 5 years.
Right, and then I have to say, and I followed it to some extent, but I was floored when I saw this element of it, and you referred to it earlier. It emerged after the trial that this expensive house in Wicklow, I think, that you mentioned, that he acquired or he bought or he was staying in, there was a dawn raid by the Gardaí in it.
So the trial finished in December. Sentencing was set for the end of January this year. In the middle of January this year, prior to sentencing, the guards raided the home of Michael Lynn, his wife and their four kids, and another four properties in other counties in Meath and Dublin associated with associates of Lynn's dating way back. And that was all to do with their suspicions that he had successfully secreted away however many millions from back in the day through the structures I was encountering when I was following him in 2007. And was able to go back into business. And maybe that's not too much of a surprise because he went back into business in Brazil before he was arrested. He had bought a development site there and was on the verge of constructing a new apartment block. So that had to be funded somehow. But back here in Ireland, to find him actively managing or consulting into or being involved with brand new companies, and there are three or four of them were established by associates of his here, during his trial or between his first trial and his second trial, to find him involved in that, to find him being able to access monies that were coming into the country, into those companies, even as he's on trial for stealing, is a fascinating aspect to the whole thing. And as I said, the associates, the individuals running those companies for him in Ireland are the same people that helped him and are linked on the paperwork to the monies that disappeared out from under the feet of creditors back in 2007, 2008. And I should say as well that it's not just Lynn that the Gardaí are investigating for current money laundering offences. It's Breed Murphy as well, because Breed Murphy is on the paperwork of those structures dating way back when with these individuals as well. Now, he could do 5 years this time, but if the money laundering charges materialise, if he's found guilty of money laundering, and she is, that's another 14-year term.
Right, and one other thing that just strikes me, Michael, is there any possibility of civil actions from his victims? Though quite obviously not, presumed maybe the banks, but I'm talking about victims like the victims you told us about earlier. Is that on the cards because of the nature of things? Is it possible? Do you see any prospect of that?
I think I wouldn't like to raise anyone's hope falsely, but I think there would be great natural justice if something like that could ever happen. If you talk to guards privately, they'll tell you that they're hopeful that if ongoing investigations result in any money being seized and him being found guilty of laundering it, that perhaps it would be just if that money was put into some sort of a structure, a compensation fund or something that could help to compensate those who lost their life savings. But I see very little chance of that happening, to be frank with you. I mean, the guards did seize, when they carried out that raid in January, they did seize more than 2.5 million euro in the accounts of the new companies that had been set up here in Ireland. That money is frozen, but it's a long way from that money being sort of seized under court order, and that court order is refreshed every 28 days if someone doesn't come and claim it. That's a long way from that money winding up back in the pockets of people who might have lost it 15 years ago.
When you hear about that level of money, it's galling in general terms when you look at what people went through after economic collapse, the vast majority of whom it had nothing to do with them because of the state of public finances. And then you see some people coming out the other end with that kind of thing. I can see how it's galling. I can see how it's exponentially galling for anybody who was a victim directly of him or this type of stuff that went on at the time.
Do you know what I'd like to say, actually, if I have a chance? I'd love any of those victims who are out there to think about coming forward and reaching out to me, because this saga isn't over, and one of the missing parts of it are those victim stories. And we have been commissioned with Fine Point Films and Trevor Burney up in Belfast to do a two-hour each documentary for RTE on this whole saga. And I'd love to include as many victims' stories in that as I could, so, you know, people can reach out and find me in the normal ways. That'd be great.
Absolutely. And to find Michael at the Irish Mail on Sunday. Michael's our investigations editor. Folks, I have to say, the book, you'd ate it, as they say, because it actually does read like a thriller. It's fascinating. It's also enraging in places when you see what was at issue. And it's also something of a history lesson, I have to say, for anybody who is not up with or wasn't around or has forgotten the kind of excesses that went on as recently as less than 20 years ago. Fugitive, the Michael Lynn story, published by Merrion Press by Michael O'Farrell. Michael, thank you very much for joining us today.
No problem. Thanks a lot for having me.
As always, I want to thank our engineer, JJ Vernon. Thank you, folks, for listening. Take it easy. We'll talk to you again soon.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me, like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.